Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with the stars and creators of the hottest shows on Broadway, off Broadway, and in the world of podcasts. I'm your host, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to Jeremy McCarter, the writer and producer behind Make Believe, the Chicago-based podcast series of socially engaged audio plays. He co-wrote the best-selling hardcover Hamiltome, called Hamilton the Revolution, with Lin-Manuel Miranda, spent 5 years on the artistic staff at the Public Theater, and recently released the book Young Radicals. He's the founder and executive producer of the nonprofit production company behind Make Believe, which recently wrapped its first 4-episode season. Now he's here in the studio with me to talk about thinking globally, acting locally, and planning what's in store for Make Believe next season. Hey, Jeremy. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Great to see you.
So you've spent a lot of your career thinking and writing about the ways that kind of theater and social engagement interact, and Make Believe is in many ways an extension of that. Tell us about where the idea came from.
That's right. Make Believe Association, the production company in Chicago, is in a sense a kind of test bed. I wanted to really push some of these ideas that I've had, some of the experiences I've had in and around the theater, and to try to make something new. I moved to Chicago a few years ago, and one of the things I really love about that place is it seems to say to you, what do you want to make? And what I wanted to try to make was a production company that would extend some of these ideals. To me, one of my favorite things about theater is there's this social aspect of it. It's a collaborative endeavor. And so a lot of the thinking that went into Make Believe was, well, what are all the ways we can get people doing things with each other? And so part of the experiment that we've been running is just like, well, let's keep trying stuff and see what happens.
Can you be a little more specific or expand on the idea of the ways in which Chicago is welcoming to something
like this?
Like more so than New York? Because a lot of people start stuff in New York. Tell us about kind of the difference.
So Make Believe, I think of it as a showcase for Chicago artists. Mm-hmm. As you probably know, the theater scene there is incredibly rich.
Yes.
And so I thought, well, this is
I'm going to have questions about that later, too.
Okay, yeah. Great. Happy to answer them.
Yeah.
But we produce audio dramas, which are like radio plays for podcast listeners. And when we record them, we record them in front of small live audiences. And the purpose of that is to give those listeners a chance to talk about the stories afterwards. So if people go to whatever app they use to listen to this podcast and search for the Make Believe podcast, what you'll hear is Chicago actors performing something that was written by a Chicago writer.
Right.
And then their neighbors and friends from Chicago talking about it afterwards.
Right.
And there's a way that Chicago has the space and has the people where it felt like you could try something like that with some confidence that it's going to turn into something that's worth hearing.
Right. How did the podcast element come about?
I've always loved those old radio plays from the 30s and 40s. I think it's such a rich form of storytelling. And in a sense, it's like theater, but more so. I mean, the thing I love best is when you go to the theater and your imagination gets sparked by something. You see something on stage and you have to fill in the blanks around it. And with audio, it's all blanks. You've just got a voice and some sound effects and some music. And it seemed to me that there's now this audience because of the boom in podcasting. Where you could try something and you could be confident that, as in the 30s and 40s, there'd be listeners for it. And audio drama in particular has seen this real surge lately. And the specific thing I wanted to try to make was to say, what if you took all the ideals and the impulses that would make someone want to do nonprofit theater, the stories you want to tell, the artists you want to tell them, and you took the theater part of it away. And then you just had those impulses and were using the storytelling tools in a new way, what would happen? And that's what we've been finding.
And so Make Believe, we should mention, is a nonprofit.
It is a nonprofit
production company.
Right? That's right. It is a nonprofit. That was important to me. We tried to do this in a non-commercial. I wanted to give the artists the most freedom I could give them. And that was the original rationale behind nonprofit arts in the first place.
Right.
And so what it requires is people everywhere, but specifically in Chicago, to support this experiment, to say that we believe that these artists should have a chance to tell stories. There should be more spaces for people to talk about stories. And it's entirely the generosity of foundations and donors that is making this possible.
Right. And you alluded to this earlier, but you work, it is very clear from listening to the podcast from sort of word one that it is a homegrown, it is from Chicago. They're Chicago artists, right. Chicago issues are raised. Right. Why was that important to you in terms of?
I think there's a way that, so I've done a lot of reading and thinking about the early years of the 20th century. And there was a moment when suddenly culture.
You just wrote a book on the early 20th century, a little bit. So I should mention, yes.
The book is Young Radicals, available in bookstores everywhere. but there was a moment where mass media came in and suddenly the cultural experiences that had always been local were suddenly national. And I think there is something that I wanted to try to recover about saying that stories should be reflecting the people and the concerns of a very small area. And because what you find is the more narrowly you define it in some crazy way, it becomes more universal. All, you know, lots of storytellers say that the specific things are the universal things.
Right.
So I just thought, let's really commit. And the you know, as we move forward, it turns out the next series that we're working on, it's not quite ready to announce yet, but we're pushing even more in that direction. To feel we want to be even more sort of reflective of what we see in the world right around us in the work that we do.
How did you end up selecting the artists that you worked with?
The choice of the artists was partly a reflection of the stories that I wanted to tell. Before I left New York, I was on the artistic staff of the Public Theater. Yeah. I ran a series there where we would do a form of this. We would read a play and then we'd give people a chance to talk about it. We had all sorts of amazing, incredible artists and thinkers take part in those events.
What was that called? That
series? It was called Public Forum.
Yep.
And those plays were chosen with an eye toward their topicality. So it would be March and I'd be planning for the things we would do in October. And part of the thinking would be, well, what's going to be on people's minds in October? And let's find a play that would reflect that. In this case, I sort of felt the opposite, that it was interesting to me at a time when we are all so consumed with the latest crisis in the news and we're on Twitter and there are terrible things that we're all responding to. What are the stories that we can tell that would give people something else to talk about? That would force people to go on some sort of imaginative journey together. And that led me to fables and folktales. Right. These are stories that by definition have been told and retold for a really long time. So there's something in them that invites conversation no matter what's going on. So I had some ideas for stories that I wanted to tell and then just looked around and thought about, well, who are the right writers to tell them? The first season, there were two in particular, writer Nancy Garcia Loza, who's incredible. She's Mexican American. She adapted a Mexican folktale, did a beautiful lyrical job with it. The other writer is Nate Marshall, poet born and raised on the South Side. I was a fan of his before we got to be friends. The first thing I did after the company was formed was to commission a play from Nate. So we were already in business. Nate did a new adaptation of the Brer Rabbit folktales.
Was the commission initially in your... He was writing for make-believe. He was writing something that would be heard on make-believe. Right.
Okay. Right.
And so you decided the theme and everything. And he knew that folklore was a...
Nope, that was before. Okay. That's what I mean. Like, as soon as there was... As soon as I had an organization to commission a writer to do something,
okay.
I reached out to Nate
and he had never written a play before? Am I remembering that?
He had collaborated with Eve Ewing on a piece about Gwendolyn Brooks. This was the first entirely his own that he had done. Right. And as I suspected, the guy is a great, great writer.
Right, right. And you mentioned throughout the course of the podcast that there is a writer's room, or was a writer's room, which is a phrase that most people associate more with TV. How did that work? And how were these three new works develop?
It was my favorite. I mean, it turns out, there's a reason why TV is so good these days. It's because the writers help each other.
Right. They collaborate. Often the room is full of playwrights also.
So those playwrights know very well that, there is an impulse behind everything that we're doing. It's this, if there is a thesis behind all of it, it is that we think better and we create better when we do it with other people, especially if they're not like us. And when I think about the way a traditional theater works, it turns out you don't often get that many chances to collaborate with the people who do what you do. So any production will have a writer, a director, a set designer, but you don't have five writers. I mean, even musicals, each person has their own sort of department. So for this, I thought, well, if there are going to be some number of people doing a similar task, then why don't they have the benefit of each other's experience? And instead of having a development process where you commission it and then maybe 5 years later, there's a 29-hour workshop or something and said, well, let's just do this in half a year. which is about as long as it took to go from pre-production to taping for the first season. But what you find is that that sort of mutual help and inspiration and feedback, if it's delivered regularly, you start to get this, the room itself starts to get smarter. That's the magic of it. And that's the part that to be honest, is closer to TV and the thing I by far love the best about the whole experience so far.
Can you give us an example of how the writer's room helped? Particularly, you wrote an adaptation of a part of a novel called The Lost Books of the Odyssey.
That's right, yes. This.
How did that writer's room help you as you did that?
So writers tend to sort of go down rabbit holes sometimes, and you're not quite sure what's coming. And so part of it is it's a little bit the incoming feedback of and also I would not let anyone hand a piece of paper to anyone in the writer's room, since what we're doing is only going to be heard in the end. Then why don't we just start hearing it from the very beginning? But so... as a writer,
each writer read his or her own?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I would read part of a draft of this adaptation I was doing of The Lost Books of the Odyssey, which is Zachary Mason's ingenious riff on Homer. And then there'd be the immediate feedback of people who were able to say how this was sounding to them based on themselves doing the exact same thing I was doing at the time I was doing it.
So the show, as it exists right now, is a recorded live performance of an audio drama, and then there is discussion or excerpts of the sort of audience discussion that came after that. Was that always the form in your head, or was that a thing you had to come to?
It was always the form in my head. There was an event that we did at the Public that I really loved helping to put together with the philosopher Michael Sandel. It was a night of Shakespeare readings by these incredible actors, Vanessa Redgrave, Matt Damon, Lily Rabe, and then Professor Sandel at the Delacorte Theater in front of 2,000 New Yorkers started asking questions about the Shakespeare readings, which had all been about money. And to see those New Yorkers waving their hands in the air, trying to get a microphone so they could talk about what they thought and debate one another about these questions, to me, is one of the great ways that you can see how stories can spark conversations. So it was really important to me to say, it was important to me to try to see if we could make that conversation that follows the story feel as collaborative as the writer's room did. Can we have a conversation, get its sort of own momentum enough that as it was in the writer's room 3 months earlier, the room is making itself smarter? And you can hear in the excerpts that are at the end of the podcast episodes that people build on the insights of the other people in the room. They share their own personal experiences, and that's a beautiful thing. And it's inextricable to me, the creative part of theater, the storytelling, and the way that it is a social experience.
Right. How many people are in the audience? Tell us about the room for those of us who haven't been there. It records at a library, yeah?
There's the Harold Washington Library in downtown Chicago has a big, beautiful theater, which has a big, beautiful stage, which is big enough, in fact, to act as a kind of sound studio. So we would close the curtain, and for three of the four stories that we did, we would put the audience of about 60 people on stage, sitting on three sides, so thrust configuration, because you are going to have a better conversation if you're making eye contact with the person you're disagreeing with.
Right.
If you're disagreeing. And I didn't want it to be bigger than that, because I think I wanted it to feel that if you had something to say, there was a reasonable chance that you would have the opportunity to say it in the time available. If there are 1,000 people there, you know you're an onlooker.
Right.
I think the intimacy of it was one of the things that gave people the freedom to really speak their minds.
Yeah, I was going to say, people are very participatory in a way that I might feel shy to be in some contexts. And I just wondered what the context...
Yeah.
What was there... Who are these people? Who did you invite and who's...
That required a lot of thought.
Yeah.
Because I knew from the beginning about the sort of non-commercial aspect of it that we weren't going to charge people. It was going to be open to whoever could get there. But if there are only going to be 60 people in the room, then that means there's going to be some criteria for entry. And to merely make it free means you're just essentially saying the audience will be the people who are getting the email. They're already on the list. They're going to be the first ones who manage to click the RSVP link. That wasn't likely to yield the audience that I was excited to hear talk about something like a new version of the Brer Rabbit stories. And so instead we tried this new model of doing it. And I thought that if we're trying to sort of build this community around stories, let's build outward from the existing communities of the people who are making the thing. So I said to the actors and the writers and my board and the people who did the sound and the music, at the top of every production, I would say, you will decide who is in the room for this. When it comes time for these live tapings, you will get to pick some number of your friends, neighbors, teachers, partners, whoever, that you think would have something to bring to this conversation. They're the ones who are going to be in the room for this. And if I've done my job right, and the people who make up the company, whether that's my board or the actors, if they are reflective of Chicago, then you just extend those the next sort of ring out means the audience is likely to be reflective of Chicago. Right. And that was a beautiful thing to see.
What have you found are the biggest challenges in recording in front of a live group of people in a library?
Where to begin? you always, every taping situation, I mean, we've...
How many times do you do the performance? It's more than one, right?
We do two of each one, yeah.
With different audiences.
Yeah. Taping is hard. Audio is tricky. I mean, since you and I have been sitting here, we are aware of noise around us.
True.
Right? And so that is difficult to control for that, to find spaces that are big enough to put 60 people, but still somehow the acoustics are good for that kind of taping. So there's all sorts of technical stuff. And then with the actors, it turns out, something that we learned as the season went on is how an actor should modulate a performance.
I wondered about that, sort of how you pitch it specifically for someone's ears.
Right. So we have the actors are on lavs. They wear microphones, clip-on microphones, to get the give them a little more freedom to move around, to deliver a natural performance. But then the trick is only think about that mic and don't think about the 60 people sitting out there. Right. For the actors with the theater background, that's a habit that they have to try to break, because if you are playing to the 60, the person who's listening to it on their earbuds on their commute a year later is going to think, this sounds big and performative, and that wasn't what we wanted it to feel like. Right. So it is, if people go and listen to the podcast, what you'll hear is this is our best attempt to solve all of these problems on the fly. Right. There's really no way to solve them until we were making the thing.
Right. Will the format remain the same going forward?
Yes, I believe so. We're in pre-production now on this next series that we want to now generate.
How it's organized around a single theme?
Yes.
Different from folklore, I'm guessing?
Yes, okay. Yes. Folklore was the sort of unifying theme. It will not be moving forward.
Right.
But the production model feels right. I mean, lots of things that we'll fine-tune, applying the lessons we learned. But the idea that we can have a performance that leads to a conversation and we have the capacity to share that at national scope, that part all feels great. And so we'll continue doing that.
The same number of episodes are you intending?
I think so. Right. And that's the part that we're still early days yet for this next series. We'll find out. But
do you have a sense of when this will be released? Is
next
it around
year,
the same timeline?
Sometime, yeah. Okay. I mean, the release phase for this season was January to March. So for next year, it'll be probably springtime.
Right. Do you, when you think about make-believe sort of 5 years down the line, do you think of it growing to encompass further activities?
I don't think so. Part of the reason is there's a way that the impulse to tell stories and to do something for a very focused set of reasons can expand sometimes a lot. And you start getting into like secondary activities and then you start needing more infrastructure. One of the virtues of working this way is the leanness of the model. So if we were a traditional theater, for the amount of money that we need to raise and the time that we need to spend, we'd be reaching a small number of people. I want to try to stay lean enough that the money that we're raising, we are able to return to the artists, or return to the production team. It's really important to me that we are not doing this with a bunch of unpaid interns doing the work. We are a SAG-AFTRA signatory, so we can try to treat the artists fairly. I just feel like if we're going to do these things for idealistic reasons, then in every way that I can, I want to walk the walk. Right. And so it's important to me to sort of resist the urge to start getting into like other lines of business. Right. I think like this model, this way of telling stories, is the thing we want to keep driving to.
You mentioned this a little while ago. You've been in Chicago for a few years now. Tell us about the theater scene there. It has as you mentioned, a robust theater scene that is lively and exciting, and all sorts of cool stuff is happening there basically all the time.
All the time. It's a huge amount. It's an overwhelming amount of cool stuff. that the storefront scene, I had been led to believe.
What is that? Tell us about the, okay. What is your impression of what the storefront scene is? Because that is a, it is, you know, storefront theater is a Chicago sort of institution in a way.
It is. I thought it was like a euphemism or a metaphor or something. Yeah. It turns out, no, they're actual
storefronts.
Like storefronts that have been like, are no longer stores. Right. And they are now like 79, 99 seat theaters where it's a tiny stage, but it's a big enough stage to, you know, put on basically any kind of play. There is just this, there's this vitality in the city where it just feels like the barriers are so much lower than they would be in someplace like New York. In New York, I mean, partly it's just really expensive to try to do anything here. In Chicago, it's not as expensive. Chicago has something like 200 theater companies now. And I forget the statistic, but like, you know, dozens are emerging each year with a lot of young artists who want to take chances. That's a little bit of what I meant about Chicago says, what do you want to make? It just, you're able, it is sustainable there in a way it might not be here. And Chicago is a more lateral city. It's not in New York. There's this sort of mental grid I think people have where there's Broadway at the top and you've got the big nonprofits and then you've got off below that. That doesn't exist in the same way in Chicago. There's obviously there's the Goodman and there's Steppenwolf, the bigger theaters, but it doesn't feel as vast as it does here. And that just sort of changes the environment somehow. Yeah.
Are there things that you feel like a city like New York or any other city might learn from what's working in Chicago?
To let more flowers bloom. I mean, I really wish there were ways that New York could sustain something like a vibrant storefront scene. And this is not to say, I mean, obviously there's a lot, there are little theaters all over the city, but I mean, it's an order of magnitude difference, I think. That's one for sure. And then that's also, theater feels more central to the life of Chicago than it does to the life of New York. Mm-hmm. I think it's just because maybe, because theaters are in people's neighborhoods and there are just so many people doing it that it just comes up in the strangest places. Like people you turns out someone is a subscriber to such and such theater. And when it feels like an everyday part of the city, that too just makes it feel like you want to get involved.
Right. Yes. I feel like I have to ask about Hamilton because Hamilton.
Sure.
It has, that show obviously changed the lives and the careers of so many people who were involved in it. And, you know, you wrote this book with Lynn and it was a great big bestseller and it's a giant, big, heavy book. I imagine most of the listeners have probably seen it. If not, it's sitting on their shelves. How did that affect you and sort of the way you thought about kind of what you would do going forward?
Yeah. One thing that, I think this is probably true of lots of people who were close to the production, is I do find that it inoculates you against the feeling that something won't work because that was such a crazy sounding idea at the very beginning. And then to see that it is now what it has become, this sort of global, possibly interplanetary phenomenon, it just shows that you sort of, if you're willing to take a big risk with the right collaborators at the right moment, that these astonishing things really do happen.
Right.
So there's that, and then just in terms of like the, you know, I feel this great sense of gratitude, to be honest. I mean, for years and years, when we were both writing about the theater, you know, it was on my mind that I wished there were things that theater was doing in a significant way. I wish that it were tapping into the energy of popular culture. I wish that it were taking on things that felt they were of urgent interest, you know, sort of public interest. And then to see this show come along that just does all of those things so beautifully. I mean, I genuinely feel very grateful that like I got to see it from up close.
Yeah. You were still at the Public, we should say, while that was developing.
That's right.
You were still there when it opened?
I was.
I'm guessing?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so it's like I say this, it's like you think about the, you know, a rock hits the pond and the waves go out and you see all the ripples that Hamilton has had like across the pond. Right. I feel like I got to watch it happen from the perspective of the rock.
Right.
And the ripples are not stopping anytime soon. I mean, that's we're how many years in now, and there's still so much more in front of it.
Yeah, it was 2015, right? So it's four already.
A long time, a whole Olympiad of Hamilton.
Correct.
Still going.
Are you working on a new book?
Not at the moment. No, I did two books in 2 years, which is a lot.
That's a lot.
That's two Chicago winters on a book deadline, which is a lot. So no. So my focus right now is the writing and producing for, you know, audiences.
Does that include more than make believe?
It might. I don't know. I mean, this is a question now. Like, make-believe has... I'm delighted to see that make-believe has taken on this identity. It has a character now. There are specific kinds of stories that make perfect sense for make-believe. It has this model.
What are they?
Well, that we reflect the city.
Yep.
That we are doing things that feel like they would get an audience talking. The process is going to be very collaborative. There begins to be a make-believe type of program. And to the extent that I pop off weird ideas that don't fit in that model, then that's always a question of just like, well, then what?
Will you write something this coming season as well?
I do not plan to, no. Okay. If this season, I'm very excited to just be there to sort of help along, support, provoke, encourage.
Will there be a larger team of writers? Because there were only two plus you.
Two plus me. And I should say, Lorraine Hansberry.
Lorraine Hansberry. Right,
the ghost of Lorraine Hansberry was present in the room.
Yeah, which, by the way, if people haven't heard that episode of Make Believe, I had no idea that play, or that, I guess, teleplay existed. And it's fascinating.
It is. She wrote it for television. Yeah. It was never produced. The idea that there's anything that Lorraine Hansberry wrote that isn't of sort of general, like, general awareness.
Yeah. Chicago and Lorraine Hansberry, we should say also, right?
It was, so again, it was a way of sort of saluting the greatest of Chicago. Yeah. But we were very proud to be able to tell that story. It's very timely because it's about the end of the world. So.
Yes. Right. It felt really weird until I realized... Real weird for TV in the 60s, but then I thought it was probably the same era as the Twilight Zone, and actually that seems about
true.
Right.
So, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
TV audiences were used to that, I guess.
And hopefully now podcast audiences are today.
Right. What can you give us a teaser for next season?
Next season, let's see. How can I tease without giving in, without giving too much away? Next season, we want to push in the direction of things that audio storytelling does really well. There's a way that it favors elevated language, like music, like lyrical speech. And there are ways that... No, that's all I'm going to say for right now.
All right.
I'll have to come back in a couple months and I'll tell all.
We look forward to hearing it when we get a chance.
Great.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thanks for being here. Nice to talk to you.
That was Jeremy McCarter, the founder and executive producer of Make Believe, which you can find on your podcatcher of choice. If you like what you're hearing on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, we'd be very grateful if you took the time to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or tell a friend. Looking ahead, Stagecraft is going bi-weekly for the summer, so I won't be back next week. But look for a new episode the week after that, when I chat with two of the creators behind Broadway's buzziest summer opening, Moulin Rouge. Thanks for listening, and until next time, see you at the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.